Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want to know how bad today's jobs report was? Canada created more jobs than we did. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being, online at barrons.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, today the 8th of July. Good to have you with us. And one does wish we could start the weekend with a better dose of economic news, like almost anything other than this morning's jobs report. It was, and this is the experts talking, not just me, it was terrible, without a single redeeming feature, unmitigated disaster, one guy said. A net gain of 18,000 jobs was the headline number, not much more than a rounding error when compared to the number of people out of work in this country. The unemployment rate rose a tick in June to 9.2%, and here's a thought. Given that the recovery is now officially 2 years old, the recession has been over for 2 years, is another way to say that. What are companies waiting for? Marketplace's Jeff Horwich starts us off today.
Where are the jobs? Well, start with this annoying conundrum. Companies continue to hold the economy back because they're worried the economy will never get going. Here's Eric Ajax, who runs a metal fabrication business in Minneapolis.
We could potentially have a double-dip recession where we're having to hire people now but lay them off a couple of months from now, and that would be the last thing we'd want to do.
Along with generally waiting for things to perk up, companies are waiting for the government to do something about it. Or not. At least make up your mind, says Doug Roberts of Channel Capital Research.
Some type of a long-term program to develop job growth, to develop industry. And until you have something like that in place, you're really just kind of tinkering with things.
The long-term level of government spending is a big question for business, says Randy Krosner of the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. And love it or hate it, he says, healthcare reform is holding companies back for now.
Both uncertainty that's in the plan itself, and of course, there are many legal challenges to it. I chair the University Benefits Committee, and it just creates an enormous amount of uncertainty about what the costs will be for permanent hiring.
Then there's productivity. Why hire when you can squeeze more from what you've got? For manufacturer Eric Ajax, the key is more training and new technology.
Even though our revenue is back to pre-recession levels, we're doing the same amount of work with 10 to 15% fewer employees.
And companies with open jobs aren't always finding just what they need. Ajax is hiring, but you'd better have the skills. The guy he just hired to run a high-tech metal press has a fresh degree in precision sheet metal manufacturing. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Politicians, meanwhile, spent their morning trying to find a silver lining in the jobs numbers. Not in an all-that-constructive way, though. Leaders from both sides of the aisle want to use it to support their case in the debt ceiling debate. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports they are having varying degrees of success at that.
The White House insists it's above stirring the jobs numbers into the messy debate on the debt ceiling. Here's White House economist Austin Goolsbee earlier today on the Marketplace Morning Report.
We shouldn't be using data as a leverage point for negotiations.
But then President Obama did just that, saying the numbers demand an immediate deal to get the economy rolling again and get Americans to work.
And the American people sent us here to do the right thing, not for party, but for country. So we're going to work together to get things done on their behalf.
The president used the phrase right now 10 times during his speech. Larry Sabato teaches political science at the University of Virginia. He says the urgency is meant to scare negotiators into action.
You want to create a sense of crisis. You have to do that to get anything done in Washington.
Sabato says Democrats are also using the jobs numbers to argue against spending cuts. Republicans say the numbers strengthen their stance against taxes. Just listen to House Speaker John Boehner.
Tax hikes on families and job creators would only make things worse.
Boehner and other Republicans say more taxes would make it harder for employers to hire. Steve East is chief economist at Height Analytics, which monitors Washington for Wall Street. He says Republicans' jabs on jobs pack a lot of punch.
Well, the Republicans can use this bad jobs report to score political points better than the Democrats can, because the bad jobs report happened under the watch of the Democratic administration.
East says, rightly or wrongly, the president will be blamed for today's dismal numbers, and that weakens his hand. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, after what you just heard, do I really need to go there? Actually, it could have been worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Right about here on a Friday is where I usually make some reference to the 5 days gone by, what the big economic stories were, and then introduce the lucky winners from our rotating cast of weekly wrap participants. Today it's Felix Salmon from Reuters, the Wall Street Journal's Sudeep Reddy as well, and the introduction is going to go a little bit like this. Jobs and debt. Guys, good to have you back.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so Felix, we'll go to you since you were the last one to say hello back to me. The question comes from the beginning of, you know, I got to pick somehow. It goes to the guy at the beginning of Horwich's piece, and he said, it's a double-dip recession that's coming back. You buying that?
I don't think the official recession masters at the NBER or whatever are going to call a recession quite yet. I mean, it's conceivable. It took over a year after the beginning of the last recession until we actually finally admitted that we were in a recession. So it is possible, but I personally doubt it. The fact is, this economy is actually doing okay. It's sort of sluggishly going along without creating any jobs. We're in a jobs recession. We're just not in a GDP recession.
Well, yeah, but Sudeep, I mean, a jobs recession is kind of painful, yeah?
It is very painful, and you generally don't see a degradation like this in the labor market with 3 straight months of an increasing unemployment rate without the economy going back into a recession. There certainly are exceptions, and we can hope that there's one this time. But the fear now is that we've come into this cycle where businesses fear a bigger problem, and it just becomes self-reinforcing, where they're not going to hire when they see signs of trouble on the horizon, then there are always signs of trouble on the horizon.
So there is a now what do we do question, right, Felix? It's the government, you know, more stimulus is not politically feasible. The Federal Reserve has said there's going to be no QE3, quantitative easing 3. So what do we do?
Well, with any luck, we can get this idiotic debt ceiling debate behind us. That's first thing we need to do, because we have this crazy noise in Washington right now, and we can't achieve anything until the noise goes away and we can actually start working together to do something substantive. And then what we need to do is make sure that any spending cuts that get agreed upon as part of this debt ceiling debate wind up happening way off towards the end of, you know, 5 or 10 years' time rather than right now, because the last thing you want when you're failing to create jobs is to cut spending and make even more people out of work.
But fixing the debt ceiling debate, Sudeep, it's whatever the likelihood of that is anytime before August the 2nd. I mean, that's not going to create any jobs, right? It just stops it from getting worse. Is that the idea?
That's really it. And the concern now is not that a debt ceiling deal won't get done. It's more and more likely to get done as you get closer, but that you rush to a deal and it's not packaged well. As Felix says, you really need to find some kind of combination of boosting short-term aid and pushing the cuts down to later in the process. And it's not clear that the people who are negotiating this behind the scenes have completely agreed on that concept yet.
Does today's number, Sudeep, play in the political horse race at all, as Nancy Marshall-Genzer's piece suggested, or is it sort of just a blip?
I think it definitely does. It actually puts a lot more urgency on Democrats, on President Obama, to come up with something, because he knows the risks here. And what we've seen in the last 10 days or so are lawmakers getting out there in front of microphones and thumping their chests. But once that's out of their system, you actually do tend to see in Washington, in the classic progression in Washington, people go behind the scenes and do real policymaking, and we might be at that point now.
Felix, I wanted to push you on this idea a little bit. We got half a minute left, plus or minus, on the idea that the economy is actually doing fine. Housing is lousy. Jobs are lousy. Where's the sunshine?
Hey, on Wall Street, people are making lots of money.
Yeah.
If you have money, you know, it's doing great. All of the returns to productivity. If you employ people and you're being productive, you get to employ a fewer people and make just as much money. So if you're rich, it's great. If you're a working person, it's miserable.
Yeah, repeat after me. Wall Street is not the economy, and the economy is not Wall Street, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Felix Salmon from Reuters and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal down in Washington, D.C. Thanks a lot, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Time.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge are here in Southern California this weekend. There's polo on tap in Santa Barbara. There's various and sundry receptions. They'll be plugging British business, too, including a project called Silicon Roundabout. Those familiar with British traffic patterns will recognize that as a play on Silicon Valley and the way the Brits drive. And it is one that the British government is backing to the hilt. From the European desk today, out on the streets of East London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
It would be hard to find a less inspiring landmark than this roundabout in Shoreditch. And yet the rather drab traffic circle has become the focal point of a glittering ambition on the part of Prime Minister David Cameron.
I believe we can make East London one of the world's great technology centres.
Cameron wants to turn a wide swathe of East London into a global technology hub, using the roundabout in Shoreditch as a starting point. Already based around this junction, there's a large community of internet entrepreneurs.
It is a natural cluster happening in the heart of the capital city, if you like, of Europe. And so we hope to create the digital capital of Europe.
Eric van der Klee has been appointed by the government to build on the success of Silicon Roundabout. There is an entrepreneurial buzz here in the cluster of converted warehouses. 3 years ago, there were just 15 startups. Now there are more than 600 IT firms of varying sizes. Elizabeth Varley runs Tech Hub, providing office space for budding entrepreneurs.
Shoreditch is really vibrant. There's a lot going on here. It's a very young community. We see a lot of innovation coming out of London, and investors are really starting to realise that.
But comparisons with Silicon Valley may be premature. The biggest excitement here in recent weeks was the sale to Twitter of a local company called TweetDeck. The sale price, $40 million. Hardly a mega deal by American standards. But the Brits have big dreams.
A great rainbow arcs over Bolton and down onto a giant steelworks where they are finishing the last huge girder for the Olympic Stadium.
As this promotional video makes clear, the Brits are pouring billions into East London in preparation for the 2012 Olympics. When the Games are over, there will be a precious legacy, 1 million square feet of empty office space available for tech companies. The government has dubbed the whole region Tech City and has put Eric van der Klee in charge of drumming up interest.
Almost on a weekly basis now, we're welcoming inward visitors, mostly investors and entrepreneurs, to Tech City. So that means we're doing something of interest.
But not as far as Rupert Goodwins is concerned. He's editor of the IT website ZDNet.
I'm not terribly impressed by Silicon Roundabout. It seems to be quite a lot of PR and hype.
Goodwin says entrepreneurs don't need hubs, and he urges anyone with a bright idea to stay at home and develop it in their garage. He argues that the plan for Tech City is overblown.
I don't see it taking off and becoming a hugely economically important aspect of the UK, because good ideas don't need to congregate anymore. Everything's in your head, and heads are very portable.
Silicon Roundabout has caught the eye of some very big established American companies. Cisco, Google and Microsoft have all expressed an interest, although none of them will be shifting their headquarters to Tech City. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, the real costs of getting to orbit.
NASA's budget is like maybe $18 or $19 billion. That's like 2% of what we spent bailing out the banks.
A space age conversation from the corner office. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, stocks sank today after hitting that unemployment iceberg. It submerged the Dow Industrials to the tune of 62 points, about 0.5%, finished at 12,657, way better than it had been earlier in the day, though. The NASDAQ descended 12 points, just shy of 0.5%, closed at 2,859. The S&P 500 dove 9 points, almost 0.75%, wrapped up the session at 1,343. Today's retreat came just as Wall Street seemed to be on a roll, though. For the week, the Dow gained more than 0.5%. The NASDAQ jumped more than 1.5%. The S&P 500 gained almost 0.33% since Monday. Shares of News Corporation, the parent of Fox and the Wall Street Journal, dropped another 4%. Today, the media giant's British scandal intensified. The Scotland Yard arrested a former editor of that newspaper. Much of today's action was in safe haven investments. The spot price of gold shot up another 1%, capping its best week of the year. Investors also flocked to U.S. bonds. The yield on 10-year T-notes tumbled to 3.02%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. By Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. And by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. A national summit on paid sick days and paid family leave gets underway in Washington. The United Nations marks World Population Day. They say we're going to hit 7 billion this year. Getting cozy. And on July 11th, 1960, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel To Kill a Mockingbird was first published. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. In what's becoming a distressingly familiar story, yet another expensive brand-name drug has been found to be no more effective than the older, cheaper ones. The drug in question this time is Neseretide. It's for heart problems. The government spends billions of dollars on medications every year that may well be ineffective. And Gregory Warner reports now from the health desk at WHYY, Washington hasn't really done a very good job of finding out what those medicines are.
When you have a heart attack, Neseretide helps you breathe. The drug was approved in 2001 and made billions of dollars for Johnson & Johnson. This week, a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that the drug, at $500 per dose, works no better than conventional treatments that cost pennies.
And it shouldn't take 10 years for us to learn the truth about a drug.
Dr. Eric Topol is an executive at Scripps Health, the not-for-profit health system in California. He blames drug companies and the FDA.
Because today the FDA doesn't have the teeth and the authority to tell a company, unless you do this definitive trial now, we're going to pull the drug's approval.
I don't think we can expect the pharmaceutical industry to be on the hook for all of that cost.
Joel Hay is a health economist at USC. He says evaluating a drug's effectiveness is expensive and needs government funding. But he says some government panels set up to study effectiveness have been sandbagged by politics. So the healthcare reform law sets up a nonprofit independent board with a $200 million budget to study which drugs and which treatments are effective. Gene Washington is the executive director.
It's not just drug A versus drug B. It's what happens to me? Is it better for me to come in to see the doctor to get this treatment, or should I be seeing a different kind of provider?
The board could publish answers to these questions by 2014 if the board is still around. There's a bill in Congress to have it repealed. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
We're going to hear from Elon Musk in the next segment. He's the guy who helped found PayPal, and we're going to be talking to him about one of the fun new ways that he's found to spend his money. But it's the company he helped start that we want to focus on right now. PayPal was something of a pioneer in the payments industry, one of the first sites that really let consumers set up an account to buy things online. The new thing in online payments is mobile, which is why it's worth a mention today that eBay, PayPal's parent company, just spent $250 million to buy a company that lets you pay for things with just your phone number. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has that story.
If you want to set up a PayPal account, you need a bank account or a credit card. But Zong will change that, says PayPal spokesman Anuj Naya.
Zong gives PayPal the ability to provide a PayPal account now with simply a mobile phone number.
Whatever you buy shows up on your phone bill. That kind of ease is essential for mobile phone purchases, says Bob Egan, director of MGI Research.
Zong's got a system that says, you know, your phone number is you. How much easier can you get?
Egan says that kind of leg up is critical right now. Everyone from Google to Visa is jumping into the mobile payment business.
Mobile phones eventually will sit at the center of electronic commerce. There's a lot to lose if people don't get in the game early.
Mobile payment transactions are expected to total $240 billion this year. But the allure for companies goes beyond the payments themselves. Industry consultant Paul Grill points out that if you buy something with your phone, the mobile company knows what you bought and where exactly you are.
That mobile handset, you know, can be used to promote products and services to consumers, to engage consumers in loyalty programs, to give them coupons.
Grill says that business could be worth a fortune. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
It was cloudy in Florida this morning, but nice enough to get the space shuttle off the ground. Atlantis is on its way to the space station, the last trip, as you know, that a space shuttle is going to make. Congress has told NASA to come up with a replacement for the shuttle by 2016. But what does the American space program do in the meantime? The answer, of course, is outsource. Astronauts are going to hitch rides on the Russian Soyuz for a couple of years. Supply runs have been farmed out to private companies, including Space Exploration Technologies, SpaceX for short.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, SpaceX founder and CEO Elon Musk. Musk has taken most of the fortune that he made selling PayPal to eBay back in the dot-com days and plowed it into SpaceX and Tesla, the electric car company. A couple of weeks ago, I went down to the company's headquarters in Hawthorne, California.
We're in the SpaceX rocket factory, which is, interestingly, just about 5 minutes away from the LAX airport.
It's a huge place. Boeing used to build fuselages for the 747 here. Now an altogether different kind of flying machine is being assembled. Technicians work on the Falcon rockets that SpaceX designed over there. Others tend to the heat shield on the Dragon space capsule. Now it's a cargo container, but eventually it's going to hold people.
When you're coming in, when you're re-entering the atmosphere, you're coming in like a meteor. I mean, you're a fireball from hell. If you don't have that heat shield, you get vaporized.
Musk has $1.5 billion contract with NASA to resupply the space station over the next couple of years. But beyond that, since he's the guy building the rockets, when we sat down to talk, I asked him where he thinks the United States ought to be going in space. Should we go back to the moon? Should we go to Mars? Where should this country go in space?
I think that we should be focused on establishing a self-sustaining human civilization on Mars. I think that should be the central focus.
How come?
What are the biggest milestones in the evolution of life itself? Obviously, it's the advent of single-celled life. There's multicellular life. There's migration of life from oceans to land. There's mammals, consciousness. You know, those are obviously biggies. And I think on that scale would also fit life becoming multiplanetary.
This is going to sound pejorative.
Is that existential enough
that's,
for you?
That's quite existential. I like that. But here's the thing. You're doing it on the cheap. There's an award out there in the lobby that says, Elon Musk, you get the award for economic spaceflight.
Yes. Well, the fundamental problem with rockets is that they are far too expensive. And so that's the thing that has to be improved dramatically.
How do you do that?
The great breakthrough that is needed is a fully and rapidly reusable rocket. No one has ever succeeded in building this. In fact, no one has ever succeeded in building a fully reusable rocket of any kind, at least that's capable of getting to orbit. Whether SpaceX does this or some other organization, I think it will be one of the most important inventions in the history of humanity.
What role, then, does NASA have? Because NASA has not been able to master that reusable and rapidly reusable part.
I think NASA has an important role. SpaceX would not be where it is today without the help of NASA. A lot of the technology that we've developed is really built upon what NASA has developed, and NASA has been our single largest and most important customer. But I also think that a company like SpaceX is important to bring sort of an entrepreneurial, sort of a Silicon Valley approach to things. There are lots of really smart, good people at NASA, but they are somewhat tied up in the constraints of a government organization.
There are those who will say, Elon Musk, you can take your money, you can do whatever you want to, but my tax dollars and my government money, we have way too many problems here at home for us to be messing around with Mars or the moon or the space shuttle or any of that jazz, importance or none.
Right. Well, first of all, I should point out that the amount of money we're talking about here is not going to solve any significant earthly problems. NASA's budget is like maybe $18 or $19 billion. I mean, that's such a tiny portion of the economy. That's like 2% of what we spent bailing out the banks. But then I'd say, let's push the argument for why it is important to spend money on space. And I think that there's an inspirational element here that should not be, you know, overlooked. If you consider going to the moon, that was a huge expenditure. And obviously only a handful of people went to the moon. But actually, in a sense, vicariously, the whole world was part of that journey. Life cannot just be about solving problems. There must be inspirational things as well. There must be things that when you wake up in the morning, you're glad to be alive. And that, I think, is what's one of the things that space can offer.
Elon Musk, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the internet. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on the way out today, playing off where we started the broadcast, Canada and its 28,000 jobs last month. That's like 280,000 jobs here once you adjust for population size. And there is going to be plenty more economics to talk about as next year's presidential election heats up. But here's a data point to start that discussion. The only president since World War II reelected with an unemployment rate above 6%, Ronald Reagan, 1984. 7.2% of the country was out of work on election day that year. And that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow sank 62 points, 0.5%. See the aforementioned jobs report. The NASDAQ carved off 12 points, not quite 0.5%. The S&P 500 down 9 points, almost 0.75%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson, the executive producer of the program. He's a guy by the name of J.J. Ewell. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. So you want to be rich like Warren Buffett? You got to get in touch with your feminine side.
Women tend to be more prudent rather than impulsive. They're patient. They're not reckless. So when I say you invest like a girl, that is a very good thing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We will be back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us.
Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.